Civil Education Authority and Population Education. I'm also we're going to the presentation of SACWA. I'll ask members to accordingly introduce themselves. Thereafter, the delegation from SACWA would do so, and immediately thereafter, I'll leave the presentation. Silence, Makuman, a member in this committee.
Sir, I'm Arthur Portan,
a member of this committee.
I'm Janita Plopper Lawrence, a member of the committee. My name is George Annas. I'm the acting chief executive.
Good morning. My name is Mark Albertine. I'm the chief financial officer of SACWA.
Ian Stradu, CFO, Department of Higher Education and Training.
Welcome to this meeting, and you can now proceed with your presentation.
Chairperson, thank you very much, and good morning to all the members. I would like to start by saying that your letter of invitation also extends the invitation to the chairperson of our board, Mr. Njeke. However, Mr. Njeke, unfortunately, couldn't be here today because there was a prior engagement. You know, it was very difficult for him when we received the invitation last week for you to change the, you know, the arrangement that he's made before. Also, Chair, I've introduced myself as the acting Chief Executive Officer. Our Chief Executive Officer, Mr. Samuel Isaac, would normally be the person that would be doing this presentation. But at the beginning of this year, he was diagnosed with cancer, and at the moment, he's undergoing treatment. The treatment seems to be successful, and he'll be back in the office in April. So, this morning he phoned to say that I must go convey, his greetings to the board. What we have done is the letter of invitation asked us to speak about the strategic plan, but also, refer to a list of achievements in terms of the last strategic plan. As well as the kind of challenges and so on. What we also felt was that it's important that we also report back on some of the issues that were raised by the portfolio committee the previous time that we were here. So what I'm going to start off is to really talk a little bit about the achievements and challenges, and then to report on some of the issues raised at the last meeting, and then I will go to speak about our strategic plan for this coming year. So the overview of the presentation is progress made against strategic imperatives and challenges still for the current financial year, because this financial year only ends on the 31st of March, and then the issues raised at the previous support presentation to the portfolio committee last year. In terms of the strategic imperatives, the first one was to continue to manage the transition and future operations with the NPF partners, that is the quality council. And there are three quality councils, the Council on Higher Education, the QCTO, as well as UMALUSI, and then the CSIS, to ensure effectiveness in the system to the advantage of learners, especially those in poor and rural communities. Now, later on. What we've done broadly is because we are in the transition between the SAPO Act and the NPF Act, one of the key things that we needed to do is to develop policy and criteria, particularly in terms of the new function, where we have to recognize professional bodies and professional designation. Yes. There are two presentations that that we've sent to the chair. And I think copies of that have been made.
Copies will be made available.
Yes. The only one on the table.
It is
there.
Behind
it. We have sent it through. But we can make it, we can certainly make it available, to members. What we have done then is we have developed, we've got a draft policy and criteria to recognize professional bodies and professional designations. And our board, which met on Saturday, has now approved it for further consultation with the ministry as well as with the quality council. Also, we have published for public comment level descriptions, and that is now in the process of being taken through the consultation processes. And then we have decided on a process for the development of criteria for the developing registration, registering qualifications, support qualifications. Secondly, Chair, one of the things that the new NPF Act is making provision for the establishment of a quality council on trade and occupation. So what SAPO has done is we have assisted the QCTO by taking on the responsibility of standard setting and quality assurance. In addition to that, also I was assigned to assist with the QCTO, particularly with regard to the development of a number of systems, but also to assist the CCO to be, to go through the kind of, legal process of becoming, I think it is a Section 2A, a 3A, Section 3A entity. We've also responded 6 staff members to the CCO, to assist them, where they work. In terms of focusing on working for community, we've set up the NQF and career advice services outline. There are 16 people that at the moment is working in the helpline, and we are getting phone calls from rural places and so on. What we've also done, we've also set up relationships with ethnic colleges and with other intermediaries, so that people can have a walk-in place where they can go to the college or to other intermediaries and they can get assistance in terms of career advice. And then we've also have a Department of Education, SAQA and SABC radio program where on a weekly basis, in 9 African languages, using the 9 African language stations, that different topics are being covered around career path. It started at the end of January, and this program was launched by the Minister of Higher Education and Training. In terms of challenges, we need to make sure that all the 7 developmental factors that outlined in the NSDSP should be taken into account. We also, we at the moment in the process of policy development, but as soon as that process over, we need to move into implementation. And we are saying that we need to do that as quickly as we can. Also, the third challenge under that imperative was that our board was only appointed at the end of the year. And so, one of the key things that we need to do is to ensure that our new board comes and, begins to function effectively in the committee. Our new chair has played an important role in terms of doing that, because we had our first first board meeting on the 16th of February, and we have set up all the board structures and all of those kinds of stuff. And as I said already, we had a strategic planning session on Friday last week, and we had a meeting on Saturday. So, that challenge, is really what that person is dealt with adequately, and as I said, the chair of our board is playing a key role. The second imperative is to continue to build research and development capacity and credibility, including information systems, international networks, and research into work and learning, in order to lead policy, legislative, and conceptual debates on key national priorities and to impact on practice. In terms of this, the kind of activities here is that we have got a research partnership with the University of the Western Cape in terms of recognition of prior learning. Also, there's a number of papers that we've developed in terms of credit accumulation and transfer, as well as lifelong learning. In terms of information systems, we've got the National Learners Equity Database, and then we also have a database for the evaluation of foreign qualifications, and we've got a good relationship with the CHE in terms of developing a database for private providers in higher education. We have been working with the SADC region to establish a regional qualification framework, and we've worked with the Commonwealth of Learning in terms of working on a transnational qualification framework. We've also been assisting Ethiopians with very quick to assist them with the Ethiopian qualification framework. And then we did a study looking at teacher training and development across the Commonwealth. Here are the key challenges. It is about looking at internal staff capacity that we need to manage very carefully, because particularly our international liaison division is a very small one. And so, the kind of work that people request of us, and then in terms of managing the research process and the deliverables is a kind of ongoing thing that we need to manage very carefully. The third imperative is advancing lifelong learning through the NQS and mechanisms such as recognition of prior learning, credit accumulation and transfer, and career advice services towards enabling the removal of systemic barriers to access information. Year chair, it is quite important. We had an RPL workshop last year in October, and this year we had a conference from the 23rd to the 25th of February, and there were members of the portfolio committee who also managed to attend this conference. Out of the conference chair came the idea that we actually need to look at asking the minister to set up a national RPL task team that will be able to work out a national strategy in terms of RPL. We have also, at the conference, got nominations for RPL reference team. I've spoken about the cattle rating, and then in terms of the career advice services, We managed to obtain funding via the NSF, 400 million over 3 years. Now, the challenge in a certain sense there was that we signed the contract in September, and we had to then move very quickly to begin to set up the career advice services. 16 advisors have been appointed, and the health plan has been established together with the FET College's project. Chair, the challenges there is that there was an indication by the department that we need to renegotiate the CAS contract, so there is a conversation happening at the moment with regard to that. Also, the point that I'm making is that during the policy development and phase, we need to be dealing, in fact, with the systemic blockages, and we can only sort that out both in policy but also, when we move to implementation. And then also, there's also partnerships that we need to manage carefully. In terms of our fourth strategic imperative, which is engage proactively with key partners to develop common understandings of the N2S as a framework for communication, coordination, and collaboration across education, training, development, and work, and translate it into practice. Now, here we have established an NTF forum. The NTF forum consists of the CEOs of SACWA and the QC, as well as the chairpersons of the board of those of the policy council. And then we've got a CEO's committee that we have, and that is the CEOs of the SACWA and the policy council. We also have got committees across the legal entity family that deals with advocacy, career advice services, and then also, in fact, with the most people. According to the SACWA Act, we need to establish a system of collaboration between the NPF families. We also need to develop an NPF implementation framework. Now, already we have developed draft documents of these, of the system of collaboration and the NPF implementation framework. So we hope, in fact, that we'll be able to approve that fairly shortly. Last year in August, the regulations for the dispute resolution was promulgated, and this deals with if there's any conflict between the QC, SACWA is responsible for dealing with that, but also if there's a dispute between SACWA and the QC, that gets referred to the Department of Higher Education and Training to sort out. Then, Chair, there's also ministerial guidelines, that we use, as well as we've taken cognizance of outcomes 1 and 5, particularly the things that the minister has signed, outcome 5, and then in terms of outcome 1 that has been signed, by the Minister of Basic Education, and we've aligned broadly in our strategic objectives, where it is possible in terms of those outcomes. We've also accepted a program of work that will move us to a situation where we have the occupational qualification framework declared, as well as the general further education and training framework. And the idea there is that we will try to do this by July. Under research, what we've also done is to have a number of seminars and conferences with all the partners so that we can develop, these ideas going forward together. At the moment, the challenge here is that there is a discussion within the NPF Forum where we begin to rethink the NPF Forum and what the CEO's committee could be doing. And then we need to set up the mechanisms to implement the dispute resolution regulation. Then the last strategic imperative, this is about creating the climate and conditions for effectiveness and advocacy and excellent service delivery to the public in the new NPF environment as defined by the NPF. Your Chair, internally, there's been clustering. We note there that the CEO was a ticketer on, and so the whole organization has to take on additional responsibility. But in actual fact, I think we have put you know, came over with that. There's also been a restructuring within our director's qualification evaluation. My apologies. There's been a restructuring in terms of our directors for current qualification evaluation. And then, as I said, the key thing was there's a change from the outgoing to the incoming board and making sure that the board structures function effectively. So all of that we have already done, In terms of advocacy, we have set up a brand ambassador workshop, and there's also a kids campaign that, you know, that is going well. We've set up an excellent services delivery project so that we can actually provide excellent service to the general public, but also monitor consistently, you know, what is coming out of that. There's the challenges, the funding for advocacy, as I already pointed out, that in particular areas, we need to manage our staff, you know, much better, and then in terms of our performance management system, that this, you know, works, you know, much better. Chair, the next part of the presentation is then dealing with some of the issues raised by the portfolio committee before at our meeting last week. This slide really just shows that it comes out of a study that was done by the OECD, where they were saying that when one looks at recognition of prior learning across the world, you can actually divide it into these different phases. The first phase is that, in fact, there's nothing, there's no policies, there's no practices, and so on. And then if one looks at the top, that there's a system of RPL in place, you know, in particular countries. Now, so here you would have that the country has got an inclusive policy, a system, a vision, and a culture regarding the recognition of non-formal and informal learning outcomes. You would see there that the third from the top is a set of consistent practices, and you would see that South Africa falls within that. So, you know, we are grouped there with countries like Australia, Canada, the United Kingdom, Belgium, and so on, where all of these countries have got a set of consistent practices. It is out of this type of the OECD that we did organize this conference that was held from the 23rd to the 25th of February. And the conference was saying we need to move from a situation where we have a number of consistent practices to having a system, you know, of RPL in the country. So the key thing then was how do we move from a set of practices to a system. So the conference then, it gives one a sense that over 342 people attended, and it also outlined who attended the conference, and you would see it included the departments, the quality councils, higher education institutions, equity quality teachers, research organizations, professional bodies, organized labor, and also providers attended. There were also a number of international guests, including delegates from military countries, from Mauritius, Botswana, Namibia, and also Angola. So there were a number of people there. And what was very good about it is that, we could draw on the experiences, you know, of all these different countries. The program of the day was we looked at lessons from countries with RPL systems. On day one, then there were three breakaway groups. We looked at three broad kind of issues. The one was resourcing RPL, how we do that. Then effective delivery models for RPL, as well as the quality assurance of RPL through RPL. And then, of course, there were all these discussion groups and so on. On day three, what we wanted to do was to get a conference resolution and also working documents emerging after that. Now, the resolution on RPL, it was agreed that the time has come for RPL to fulfill its promise. And what is needed, a well-resourced integrated approach was needed. That the moment is an opportunity for a renewed partnership between all the key stakeholders in the national learning system. That we need to have at least one national biannual meeting of all stakeholders is needed for RPL information sharing and joint RPL work. We need to write to the minister and ask the minister to appoint a ministerial task team on Parkfield that can drive a national strategy, and that we, you know, and that we actually need to set up the Parkfield reference group, which is a much broader group that can support, you know, the policy development and so on. And we've got 51 nominations for that. Also, working group has emanated from the conference. Now, what we have done is we have put the RPL resolution on the website, on the SACA website, as well as the working documents. And people have got until the 31st of March to continue to make input into their documents. We will then define it, and then we will then submit that together with a letter of motivation to the minister for the setting up of RPL task. Okay, Chair, I mean, you know, that is, all the other things, in fact, is a little bit more detailed, so I'm not going to, you know, to kind of go through that Chair, the other issue that was raised by the portfolio committee was, when we came here the last time, there was, you know, we indicated that all the positions were not filled. What we have done now is that our staff complement in the current year has increased by 24%, by 27 positions. The staff turnover during the year was 8%. It is much lower than the national average and so on. In fact, I think that we are retaining our staff pretty well. We also appoint 29 people, so currently we only have 8% of vacancy that is there, so there's a huge improvement in terms of where we were before. In terms of the career advice, I've spoken extensively about that earlier, but this is a flagship program of with the Minister of Education, and it's been implemented by ourselves. I've spoken about the National Register of Claims, reaching an estimated 2.5 million people in 9 African languages. We also participated in the Mandela Day Career Festival last year, and we will participate again this year. The idea this year is to have a career in Fiji, where we will participate as a partner with the department. We've got a national website that receives approximately 6,500 unique visitors and 60,000 page impressions per month. And then the national helpline, we have recorded over 1,000 cases per month. And again, as I said, when one looks at this, it is that the spread in terms of people getting through to us is quite important. It's not only the helpline, but it's also through SMS. People SMS us, you know, we respond and then we'll respond to people back. And we are covering, you know, from urban areas to rural areas. We've also set up a knowledge database where we look at all the cases, you know, and it's a system, in fact, you know, to help the helpline staff. Plans to establish an online system for learning pathways, learning directory, and CV and RPL portfolio folder is underway. The Career Advice Service has also appointed 9 additional helpline staff members, bringing the total to 16. An office manager was appointed, and we've got a position now. We've got a person that is serving as a deputy director in a central position, you know, to help manage this from February 1. Chair, this is really, you know, it is a kind of sense to say that very often when we speak about the helpline, people are saying, oh, is it just a hotline? And what we are saying, in fact, it is not just a helpline. There is a whole number of sub-projects that is part of that, including, you know, the, you know, various bits of advice, the print media, walking centers, a knowledge base. I've spoken about the database, the IT system that supported the website development, as well as the social marketing. In fact, we also have Facebook, Twitter, you know, that people can also, you know, come in. So in other words, it is a much broader process than a simple hotline. and in broad terms, the way that we conceptualize it, that, for example, if we have events like the radio program, or we have public events, which is exhibitions, the Mandela festivals, and so on, we give people the information, and they are able to, if there's any questions, they're able to contact the multi-channel helpline. And also, they are then also able to go to the website, they are able to go to the walk-in centers, as well as career advice materials, you know, that they can consult, as it were. So it is a kind of, you know, a system that works in an integrated way. In terms of fraud prevention, when we were last at the portfolio committee, what happened, Chair, was we had a situation where there were two staff members, in particular the one staff member, you know, tried to make a fraudulent certificate that, you know, that that was given to one of our clients. We were able to, you know, to detect that in the system. And so the portfolio committee was saying, you know, have a look and tighten, you know, that. So what we have done, we have instituted the existing disciplinary action against the individual, both of them. We were dismissed. We also went and relayed criminal charges against them. So the police is actually taking up this particular matter. We also run fraud prevention and awareness workshops for all the staff in SACWA. And we also enhance our recruitment processes. We do the verification, you know, of all the qualifications concerned. And we also check whether people have got criminal records and so on and so forth, so that we don't, you know, include bad apples. There was an internal audit. So our internal auditors, you know, we went and we asked them to do a specific audit in terms of our directors for foreign qualification evaluation. And they came back and they said that the environment, you know, is involved and so on. So we are happy that we have dealt with all the matters that were raised at the portfolio committee chair. So, you know, so that the views were the request, you know, from the portfolio committee. I'm happy to take questions now. If you want, I can go on to speaking then about the strategic plan.
In terms of the 11 positions that are vacant, whether they're all funded, and if you saw the flag goes to be filled in the next 3 months, but that is the position that government is taking. Now, I want to check with you whether you have a risk management strategy, whether you have got a fraud prevention plan, whether you have an internal audit function, meaning particular people employed by your institution, whether you've got an audit committee in place that will operate in accordance with the charter and so on. If those are in place, then we are sure that indeed they will detect the impulse in your system and make necessary recommendations, and that management will act in accordance with recommendations. Our experience is that when these people advise management on how to make improvements, those are put on the side of the desk and are never attended to. And we need that assurance from you that indeed in your case there is a very meticulous attention to whatever proposals are advised by the audit committee and the internal audit team. And I think thereafter, I'm sure the audit committee should be able to ask them a question and allow them to ask questions. And
thanks, just a few issues which may need to be clarified, even if some are common, but I think they are taken up. In terms of particularly those issues that were raised with the committee before, like on members involved in the social and ultimately dismissed, we may be happy that it's not taken in that regard. But I'm just concerned if they went on the basis of the committee or the pressure being put by the committee and might not have followed their own procedures that needed to be followed. As to whether that in terms of their policy is very offensive, whether that member or employee don't even have to be given a warning. I'm just giving an example. That was it our pressure to say that you missed or it was based within the laws for the there's no understanding in how section the disciplinary hearings are handled. On the career advice service and claim that that system has reached out to rural areas, practically also, because I know that it's very difficult to reach rural areas, not as easy as to, even if you put your few things, whether it's SMS or whatever, it's not very easy to say that some of those SMS from rural areas. I'm just saying you need an extra effort to reach rural areas, and I'm interested in understanding how that happens. In that case is chair, already you alluded to that you would be able to see that all of those in the over time. Particularly because 5% of the 8% you refer to is at managerial level. So I think our interest is to ensure that 5% of the 8% is at managerial level, and which makes it more serious. So saying we want to see that ending. The last two chapters, I don't want to take other members' time. It's on RPF. There has been claimed by other institutions that they're doing that implementing in South Africa. I'm not just referring to whatever others are doing elsewhere. And I thought that perhaps the least we needed to take was to look at expansion. That's whether given that there are institutions that claim to be doing something, although from our side we're not satisfied that they're very well done. But then we expected that part of the strategy would be to say, how do we expand work in that regard beyond the institutions that are claiming to be doing something? Still on RPI, the declaration was not adopted, which gives an opportunity until the end of this month to make input. I'm just wondering how do you adopt or finalize it when members are called, when participants attend this to conference are called. It means somebody somewhere will be sitting and saying, yes, this input makes sense or does it to constitute the final one. Or how do we make sense of the final document when those who were party to the discussion are not there to then ratify or endorse the final document, and I think that would be the problem. The very last chair, DFQEAS revenue. What does this mean? What revenue is that? I'm just interested in clarity on understanding that.
Yeah, I only have a few short questions. The first one is on career advice service. You referred to the 9 radio stations, the 9 African languages. Who exactly is the target audience for this service? And does this service also include specifically career guidance? And how does it link up to the guidance at schools and universities? You also referred to the helpline. What kind of questions do you get? My other question is on RPL and the relationship with the Western Cape. Could you please give us some more information on this relationship and work and the outcomes of this relationship? You also mentioned international relations under international relations, specifically the Ethiopia qualification framework. Why specifically Ethiopia? And then on fraud prevention, I recently received an anonymous call from the department indicating that certain senior staff members were in possession of fraudulent certificates. Do you have a system by means of which you can screen certificates? Thank you.
Sorry, Chair, the third question I didn't get, I mean, I got the one on the free advice, the interpolation, and the fourth prevention. What was the third one?
The third one was on Ethiopia, the Ethiopian policy
framework.
The RCL, the relationship with the Western Cape.
RCL in relationship to the Western Cape.
Yes, yes. You refer to research done by the University
of the Western Cape. Yes,
yeah, University of the Western Cape.
So what is the question?
Can you give us some more information on that?
Okay.
Exactly what the relationship entails and what work has been done in the past and so forth. Thank you.
Chair, the question around the policies around fraud prevention. We have all the policies. We've got a charter of ethics and values, you know, that is in place. We've got, you know, fraud prevention policies. Our audit committee, you know, is functioning very well. Audit committee is also our risk committee. We report. You know, to the executive committee as well as to the board. You know, it's a standing item under the CEO's report. So we've got all of those policies in place. Now, Chair, the reason why this issue came up was in our annual report last year, we came and reported to the portfolio committee that the fraudulent stuff was detected within the organization. We also had reported last year that particular action was taken, and you know, so that is when the issue came up. So in other words, we came and we reported all of those things, and it was in terms of our own processes that we detected the thing and so on. Now, we also reported then that there were a number of things that we were going to do, you know, to further strengthen, these particular issues. And what I reported here today was the additional things that we have done, you know, after that. So it wasn't necessarily because of the pressure from the committee, but I do think it's quite important, and hence the reason why I reported it in this way, is to say that we have raised it last year, and we wanted to give the committee feedback on what has happened subsequent to that. Then, Chair, in terms of the vacancies, the point that you've made about that. I mean, the president was outlining clearly that, you know, all these vacancies must be filled within 3 months, and there are recruitment processes, in fact, you know, that is there, and we don't foresee a problem, you know, in terms of that. The questions about RPL. Now, I have said that there are. You know, the whole conference was based on the idea that there are a set of consistent practices. I do understand, in fact, that there are areas where people say particular things. You know, so the issues of quality is quite an important issue also that one needs to take into account. But the premise of the conference was we actually need to expand, we need to talk about the system, and not only in terms of... the practices and so on. So that is one thing that is clearly on the agenda, and we hope, in fact, that through this particular push, you know, that indeed will be the case. We also believe that if we do get, a kind of clear signal in the minister, with the ministerial committee, we can also, you know, do quite a lot in terms of expanding the work, you know, even further. The question about the declaration, the member is correct. What had happened was that the declaration was not agreed upon by the conference delegates. However, what had happened was that a resolution was agreed to, and the resolution has got the main element, you know, to take us forward. We've agreed that we will not call it a declaration, but we will call it, as I did, you know, it's a kind of working document, you know, together with the other reports that was given at the conference. So, so what we have done is, you know, in addition to us placing it onto the website, we've also emailed, you know, people, you know, what came out. And the idea, in fact, is that we will be able to get all of those things in place. And then we will then say, look, these are, we've taken all the comments into account. We'll send it to people, you know, email, post, and so on. Those people who don't have email and those who have access to it, so that we can get a kind of general consensus around it. But, I mean, we haven't budgeted for another conference or bringing people together, you know, in this particular way. In the resolution, it does speak about that we actually need to, on a biannual basis, try to bring all the key stakeholders together. So, but I think there was sufficient consensus, I think, in terms of broadly where it is that we need to go to, that was taken up in the resolution. Chair, the question about the Directorate Foreign Qualifications Evaluation and Advisory Services, it talks about revenue. Now, Mark, you know, will be able to, you know, to say a little bit more about it. Maybe Mark, if you can respond to that question.
Sure. Thanks very much, Chair. What that revenue when people come in from overseas to study or work, to get a work permit, we need to do a evaluation of their foreign qualification to say what is the, we give them a certificate to say this is the South African equivalent in terms of our NQF framework of what their foreign qualification is. And for that, we charge a fee on a cost recovery basis to be able to produce and give them that certificate.
Thank you, Mark. Then the question around international relations, and in particular, why Ethiopia? I mean, it's a very simple answer to that question. What we do is when people request us to assist them, you know, we would then assist them. In this particular case, what had happened with Ethiopia, you know, they sent a delegation to South Africa, which we've hosted. And then they ask whether we could assist them in thinking about their qualifications framework. And, you know, so that is what we do. We don't go out of our way to say, you shall have a national qualifications framework. We really wait, you know, for people to, you know, to ask, you know, and then, you know, and what we also do, I think, which is important, we also look and we would advise people, you know, we would ask them, you know, do you really need a national qualifications framework? Because in some cases, you know, there are so many other needs that people have. You know, this is not the first thing that should be on the agenda. So it's a very critical engagement, you know, that we do have on request. Chair, the question in terms of the question in terms of the career advice and the relationship to career guidance, schools, and so on. One of the key things that the minister has asked us to do is now, in terms of you know, one of his outcomes, is to convene a task team where, in fact, you know, we'll be trying to pull together, in a kind of broad sense, you know, a broad career advice and career guidance, career development framework, as it were. So, you know, through this particular mechanism, we will then be able to look at the system as a whole. But when we started out, you know, we started out by, you know, putting together the proposal for the helpline. But the additional work that the minister has asked us to do now, we'll be able to, you know, to drive the process broadly to get the tasking going so that one can actually deal with all the other aspects as well. The final question in terms of the the issue about RPL and the University of the Western Cape. What we have done is we have entered into a number of partnerships with a number of universities, particularly when it comes to research, because our belief in fact is that the research capacity is based at the university. We don't want to set up another another university, at Sakwa and so on. So the University of the Western Cape has been leaders in the field of recognition of prior learning research, and so so that is what we have done with them. Now this research really just started, as it were, and the research in the Western Cape is based on looking at different sites, whether it is the workplace, a community site, and so on, so that we can see what are the kind of issues that emerge and what is it that prevents RPL from being easily implemented. Now, the problem in a certain sense is when one talks about policy, from a policy perspective, one wants to get answers quickly, but research takes a bit of time and so on. So it will still take a few years for us to be able to to get the kind of results from that. So it is a process that we are following. In terms of fraudulent certificates, now one of the key things that we do have is the National Learner's Record Database, and we have got a register of registered qualifications, as well as who the people are who have got those qualifications. So the Department of Public Service Administration has asked us, in fact, to verify a number of qualifications. In particular, before senior appointment is made, we do the verification on behalf of DPSA. So in fact, this is a parliamentary question that we have to deal with as it were. The question about how do we reach rural communities, as I tried to outline in the presentation, that what we do is we actually go and we have a number of exhibitions in different kinds, in different areas. One example is the example of what happened in Giyani last year, where together with the department and a whole range of stakeholders, we went to a FE college in Giyani, and and the community in fact was brought to the FE college. We also had a situation where people have given 67. I mean, there was a interaction with a number of professionals, that happened and gave advice to learners and so on. Also, there was a whole range of material that was handed out, at the day, as well as the helpline number and so on. So that is one example. I mean, there's a whole range of others. For example, I went to Pietermaritzburg, and the number of surrounding communities and so on. Again, there was we'd spoken, we'd handed out the material, and so on, and working with a number of communities and so on, on the ground. Now, if I would say that we have completely cracked the problem, I mean, it would not be the kind of right perception. But I do think, in fact, that we are reaching areas that we haven't reached before. Quite clearly, we actually need to enlarge and improve on it. But again, with regard to this, you know, I said that we only signed the contract in September last year, and we've set up the thing and so on. So it will be useful, in fact, that we do have a monitoring and evaluation function, you know, so that we see what are the areas that we are reaching and so on, and what we can learn, you know, from previous experience. In fact, we sent in a team of researchers to Giani to do research in terms of who did we reach, were the kinds of information that we were given useful, how can we improve and so on. And those lessons we will then take forward when we do the next, you know, big event, which will be with the schedule for the CTCT, you know, in July this year. Okay, I think that answered all the questions, Chair.
I'm sure if there's any question, we can raise it after the first, just because of time.
Chair, in terms of the staff plan, I'm going to, you know, deal with the first part of the staff plan, and then Mark Albertain will deal with all the issues around the budget, and then I will speak about risks, you know, at the end. The overview of the presentation is strategic planning context and background, the strategy, the budget and finance, and then the risks. In terms of context, what we have taken into account is the change in role and responsibilities for SACWA, the new responsibilities for the quality councils, the CHE and Umalusi, and the establishment of the QCO, and then the appointment of a new smaller board. In terms of other changes in the NCAB landscape, the ministerial career advice services project, director from the Department of Public Service and Administration to government departments only to use the NLRD verification service, the new CETA landscape, and then the National Skills Development Strategy number 3. The vision is a world-class NPF for South Africa, and our mission is to ensure that further development and implementation of the NQF, which contributes to the full development of each learner and the social and economic development of the nation at large. In terms of the strategy, the overall strategy, Chair, comes from the NQF Act and the related legislation, including the Higher Education Act, and amendments, as well as the Malusi, the Skills Development Act and amendments and so on, and then the regulations from the Skills Resolution. So we take all of those things into account. Then, as part of the NQF Act, the minister is meant to give SACWA and the QC guidelines and strategies for the NQF. There is a draft that has been developed, and we also had a look at that input, and we are waiting for the final one, but we have taken, you know, these things seriously. Also, the minister wrote a letter to the chairperson with his appointment and said, these are the kinds of stuff that the chairperson should be mindful of. And well, the minister also made an address to the incoming board of SACWA. So all of those, you know, we kind of listen to that. We also take into account the national policy environment, which includes the new growth path, the human resource development strategy, the national skills development strategy, the presidential outcomes, as well as, you know, we also signed a declaration at the skills summit and so on. So we take all of those issues into account. More specifically, Chair, in terms of the draft guidelines and strategies for the NQF, it requires us to develop a system of collaboration, an NQF implementation plan, and I've said already we have started that, although it is part of our new plan. In the draft guidelines, the minister speaks about urgent delivery requirements, which is implement the fundamental components of the NQF, the standard setting, quality assurance, progression, and information system. The new NQF standard setting apparatus of the NQF should be completed and put into operation by 2012. The new NQF quality assurance apparatus of the NQF should be completed and put into operation. The new progression apparatus of the NPF should be completed and put in operation, and the new NPF information apparatus should also be completed and put into place. Chair, the imperatives for this year is similar. It is that we need to continue to manage the transition from the SACWA Act to the NPF Act. We need to continue to support research, development capacity and credibility. We need to advance lifelong learning. We need to engage proactively with key partners and create the climate conditions for effectiveness and so on. So I've spoken at length about that. Our strategic objectives and chairs were advised the minister and inform policymakers that make their recommendations on all NPF matters. We need to position SACWA as the oversight body and guardian of NPF values and coordinate an effective public NPF advocacy and communication strategy. We need to engage proactively and coordinate the work of NPF partners to ensure systemic coherence, articulation and implementation. We need to register high-quality, nationally relevant and internationally comparable qualifications and part qualifications that meet national criteria. Recognize professional bodies and register professional designations on the NQF. Conduct all research together with the research partners and publish reports of issues of importance on the NQF. Monitor and evaluate education and training across the three sub-frameworks. And maintain and further develop the National Learners Record Database. And then collaborate with SACWA's international counterparts and keep its NPF partners informed regarding international reading practice. Advance lifelong learning through credit accumulation, transfer, recognition of prior learning, and career advice. This one deals with providing an evaluation and advisory service with respect to foreign qualifications and then support targeted education, training and development communities. The issues about effective governance as well as alignment of our human financial and infrastructural resources to support the achievement of the objective. So, Chair, that is broad. Is what it is that we've set out in our strategic plan. Mark will now take us through the budget, the finance, and the plan, and I'll come back and talk about the risk later.
Thanks very much, Joe. Thank you, Chair, members of the committee. I'm just going to quickly take you then through the specific budget. I think to start off with, firstly, we need to understand what are the assumptions under which the budget has been drawn up. Firstly, that it's in terms of the NQF Act, and I'm just going to run through this quickly and highlight a couple of things. We've made a provision for 6% in terms of inflation increases for staff. The next one, you will see that we also, in terms of incentivizing staff and to ensure performance, we've got a performance culture, and that broadening adjustments have been provided for. Then inflation of income at approximately 5%, except for the DFQ EAS revenue, which was the member's question earlier, that's for the evaluation of foreign qualifications, and we see the revenue there at 13.4 million for the coming financial year. And then in terms of the National Learners Records Database, and that was what Joe mentioned earlier, that's really the directive from the DPSA in terms of the evaluation of the qualifications voting, and we see the revenue of $6 million coming in there. Now, I think important to note on both of those two projects that we do the fees that we charge is really on a cost recovery basis, so the income to cover the costs. Then the next bullet point is that we provide for inflation on costs at 5%. And really, if the inflation is higher than that, we need to make sure that we use our resources more efficiently and effectively to ensure that we achieve our operational goals. Obviously, we're quite aware that just getting an unqualified audit report in itself, you know, that doesn't help if we don't achieve our goals and objectives. So we see that as equally important in what we do. Then the next slide is that funding from the government in terms of the government grant will be $41.4 million. I will talk to you that a little bit later as well. And then we will look at getting additional project funding. And one of those projects is the Career Advice Services. That's one of the projects that we have got. Then I think important to note is that not all of the objectives in the strategic plan are implemented unless we get further funding or grants. There's a slide later on, and we can talk to some of those. And then lastly, you'll see that in terms of the new financial year, we've got a total of 48 new and 7 contract positions will be created, and which will increase the overall staff complement to 178. Then, looking at the medium-term revenue estimate, in terms of the income side, you will see that the non-tax revenue is 32.8, and that's really, it's just a classification, but that's the foreign qualification evaluation advisory services revenue. That's the revenue from the verifications project. There's a little bit of rental income and some interest income, and that's really what is in that line item. You'll see the government grant for 11-12 is $41.4 million. And then the donor project funding, that's the project, that's the funding from the National Skill Fund for the Career Advice Services project of $28.9 million. It gives us the overall budget of $103.1 million. Then if we go on and we look at the expenditure side, you will see compensation of employees. Of the $103 million, $61.5 is compensation for employees. That includes staff training, recruitment, educational assistance, and then everything to do with the employees. In terms of the goods and services, $37 million, and transfer payments, insurance, workman's compensation, et cetera, $202,000, which gives the expenditure of $99 million. And then the next slide, please, Joe. Then the balance of the $103 million gives the expenditure on property, plant, and equipment, and that's really all your IT infrastructure, furniture, fittings, all those sort of things. We see for the coming year $4 million. That is a little bit up on prior years because of a lot of the capital investment into the IT systems, partly for the Career Advice Services project. Thanks, Joe. Then to look at the overall budget in a different way, we've structured four programs. We'll see Program 1, Admin and Support, which includes also the Career Advice Services project of the department and the minister. Program 2, the Recognition and Registration. Program 3, the National Learners Records Database, including the Verifications project. Then lastly, Program 4 is the Foreign Qualification Evaluation Advisory Services. Now, the next couple of slides, I'm really going to talk to what are some of the functions that we're going to fulfill in each of those directorates. Or programs. The first one is admin and support, and you'll see that's really the first part of that is the executive office. And really they maintain and build the relationships with our principal stakeholders, the department, partners, and stakeholders. They also they're running the Career Advice Services helpline and also the custodians of good corporate governance, compliance, etc. within the organization. Although they fall under the program of admin and support, obviously they really actually are not a support role. They're obviously critical in being able to carry out SAPA's mandate. The next one is the International Liaison Directorate, and we have chatted briefly on that. And I think it's interesting to note that across the world, there's currently about 130 different countries across the world that have got a national qualifications framework. Now, SAQA is fortunate to be able to play a leading role, and that's really just because of our diverse population and our culture and our history. And we're really able to add value to a lot of the other countries in terms of some of the things which they haven't necessarily even considered. And so that is, we are able to do that. And as Joe's mentioned earlier, we don't go out and look for work. It's really when people approach us and we assist them. Okay. Then finance and admin, and that's really, we support the strategic decision-making. We do scenario planning and analysis, obviously manage the cash flows. We look at occupation, health and safety, and obviously full compliance with all the regulations, the PFMA, triple PFA, Treasury regulations, and King 3, Code of Corporate Good Governance. Okay. Then moving on to the next part of admin support is our Human Resources Directorate. They obviously look over all of the HR and manage the HR stuff. I don't need to go into detail there. And I just want to add that, you know, they largely assist SACWA to be able to maintain its investors in people status. So we're quite proud of that, and we really make a point of looking after our staff, doing our best that we can at that. Then also part of admin support is our information technology. And obviously we want to deliver a robust, sustainable, secure, and responsive technology environment. And I think one of the things that I can highlight here is that SACWA really has a 99% uptime in terms of its systems. So we think that's really excellent record. So, you know, less than 1% of the time we're not up and running, so which is a fantastic achievement. Then if we look at the advocacy initiative, we undertake appropriate market research, and that's really aimed at the public and the learner. So we need to understand, do they know about the MQF, do they know what it can do for them? And obviously, if we don't know what they do know or what they don't know, it's very difficult to meet the expectations and see how we can deliver to the learner. Okay. And look, we interact with the market. We do some brand ambassador. One of the projects is the Masatesi project we have. So let's talk with the people. Let's engage with them. Let's interact. Okay. Then we're looking at strategic support, and that really works also with our advocacy. We build a brand with partners and stakeholders. They provide internal communication. They host and participate in conferences and workshops. They also manage the NQS and SACWA websites and do the file and record management. Chair, I'm going to see them fairly quickly. They are there. Then the last part of the admin and support program is the research. And we need to advise the minister and inform policymakers on MQF and education-related matters. Now, one of the things that research does is we gain intellectual capital and empirical evidence to be able to equip us with that knowledge on the MQF to advise the minister appropriately. Then looking at program number 2, and that's really the recognition and registration. And there we facilitate the smooth transition from the old to the new landscape. Previously, the standards generation and quality assurance functions were housed in SACWA, and now those have moved to the quality councils. So obviously, we assist in the smooth transition thereof. Okay. And in consultation with the QCs and professional bodies, we need to develop policies for the new landscape. And then we need to register these and make sure that they articulate across the sub-frameworks. One of the new functions that SACWA is required in terms of is to provide the recognition of professional bodies and the registration of designations that falls within that directorate. And you will see this directorate also largely supports the QCTO and assisting the QCTO to get it up and running. Now, the seconded staff that Joe has mentioned earlier, they form part of this directorate within SACWA. Then the third program is the National Learners Records Database. And now just to recap, what is that database? Now, this database is a database of learner achievements. It's a database of accredited service providers. It's a database of qualifications that are registered on the National Qualifications Framework. And it's also a database of registered assessors. Now, obviously, what we also then do is market the NLRD to key clients in the public and private sector. We populate the NLRD with all the relevant data. And what we can do is we research that data and we develop reports for information and decision-making from the data. The NLRD supports the other directorates within SACWA, and also the last bullet point which we have talked to is the verifications project that we undertake in terms of the DPSA directive. Then the last program is the Foreign Qualification Evaluation and Advisory Service. And really, I did mention previously to the members' question what they do, provide the evaluation, the South African equivalent of the foreign qualifications. Now, we need to position DHQ EAS as a relevant value-adding partner. We want to use the information in our database to look at trends, etc., and provide information to the MQF system. And also part of the plan in the year is to enhance the existing products and develop new products and services that we can offer. Chair, that's really in terms of the programs and the budgets. Just the last couple of slides, I think, in terms of the budget challenges that we're facing. We have received budget cuts in terms of the government grants of $2.4 million for each of the 11, 12, 12, 13, and 13, 14 financial years. Now, this does affect us and it presents some challenges to us. Just in short, in terms of our strategic process and our budget process that we follow each and every year, we look at our mandate, we look at what we need to achieve and our objectives, and we start off with, we call it our scenario one budget. What's our ideal budget that we would need to be able to perform all of that? And really from there then, usually, well, in the last 5 years, that hasn't there hasn't been sufficient funding to meet that. So then we have to do budget cuts to get to scenario two, and then further to scenario three budgets. Now, that scenario three budget is obviously where our income meets our expenditure, and obviously that has some consequences for us. And that was in terms of the budget assumptions. If you'll recall, I said that we would need to prioritize and show unfunded mandates. So really, in terms of the budget challenges, if we look at that, what are some of the deliverables that will be affected by that? And if you look at the strategic support and the advocacy, Joe, I think you can just go through. I'm not going to read through all of them, but really you will see coming through there is we'll be able to do things on a limited scale or fewer implementation of certain deliverables. So really we need to scale down in that, and that's one of the things that we need to take into account. In terms of the NRRD, limited enhancements to the data testing and loading program, limited development in terms of some of the reporting, the things that we do, and it could have some influence on some of the professional bodies. So really, those are the main deliverables that are affected, and it does affect some of the other directors as well to a limited extent. I'll now hand over to Joe.
That's just one more aspect before we pass. Then, in terms of ordinary, how much would you require to be able to adequately
undertake these tasks? In terms of our scenario one budget that we had initially submitted, that was $112.5 million. And you can see we are now $103 million. So that would be an additional, let's say, $10 million. I think one also needs to just take into account that included in the $103 million is we did get approval from Treasury and from the Department to use $7.5 million funds from prior years that, you know, we'd rolled over into the year. So obviously one needs to take that into account as well.
Chair, just briefly, that is part of the risk management plan. There are two kinds of things. In fact, what we do do is, you know, have a very detailed risk management plan. What I'm just really going to do is to highlight, you know, just a few of these. We call these risk prioritized risks. Now, in terms of the scale that we use, that and risk are measured on two things, the likelihood that it will happen and the impact that it will have if it happens. So it works on a scale from 1 to 5. So if the likelihood is 5 and the impact is going to be devastating, will be 5, then, you know, if you say 5 times 5 gives you 25, that will be a high risk. If it's between 25 and 16, that is where we highlight it, and then we develop particular kind of measures to deal with that. If the risk is in the region of 1 to 9 and so on, it is not a high risk. And then if it's between, it's about 12 and so on, what we do, we assign below a staff member to kind of deal with that. So these are the risks between 16 and 25 that we are talking about. In terms of resources, financial, risk is insufficient budget to support the planned activities. Now, Mark already spoken about the way that we deal with it. We do a three scenario budget. Scenario one is our ideal budget, and then scenario three, normally, we then say these are the kinds of things that we can't do if we don't have, the money in the pot. Also, it meant that there's adequate money in terms of advocacy. The kind of idea, in fact, is that very often, when there's limited budget, the first thing that goes is advocacy. In other places, people kind of cut on training with the staff development training reports and so in terms of human resources, the loss of skilled staff to the system and key activities therefore not completed and at the required level of quality. Our staff is very important in terms of the kind of specialized nature of the work that we do. So if we lose them, it is an issue for us. Also we've got a number of very specialized IT systems. A number of those systems. If, for example, for some or other reason we lose either the staff or the contracted individuals, we may have a difficulty there. In terms of IT infrastructure, insufficient resources to ensure that the business continuity of such a system, we've identified it as a high priority. And then access required from outside stuff, but there was attention on actors and mischief makers of the taxes and services resulting in unacceptable recovery time. So it is something that is high on our agenda, and we have got a number of different plans in place, to deal with this particular. So that is at the level of resources, at the level of operations. The verification project for us is a high reputational risk, particularly if we're not meeting the deadline. If there's a high level of quantum that needs to be made, we need to do that, within a specified period and so on. The other point about this is, apart from meeting the deadline, also, if we are saying that a person doesn't have a qualification, we must be absolutely sure about that. We can't say something and it is not correct. So again, it's about reputational risk, and how we deal with that, is quite a difficult part. In terms of the National Limits Equity Database, the risk of disseminating incorrect information and also not meeting stakeholder needs. The new NPF landscape, the transition from the SACPA Act to the NPF Act, but in particular, the full operational capacity at the QC level, if that is slow to achieve and impact synchronization. At the moment, the key issue for us is that the QCO must be up and running, because if there's one QC not functioning, it means that the system as a whole is not functioning properly and so on. It's an area that we are particularly concerned about. And hence, we took a decision on Saturday that we will continue to support the PCO by having our six staff members to conduct the PCO for staff. But the key thing is that the PCO must become operational chair, otherwise we will be limping. QCs develop at different rates and is not able to collaborate with SACPA and with each other. And then, the issues about the resource capacity, is an important one. So, in broad terms, Chair, those are the high-level risks that we do have plans for in terms of how we're going to manage, and that is taken care of in the detailed plan that we have. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much. Can we take questions, colleagues?
Chair, thank you very much for the presentation. Again, I don't know if I speak on behalf of other members, but I think we would have loved some more targets, goals, measurables in the strategic plan. My question is rather a wide one, and that is, are you assured, can you assure us that the South African National Qualifications Framework is still in line with the future needs, the international best practices, etc., and appropriate for South Africa? We have seen the damage done to the South African education system when we adopted an education system that was not appropriate for our needs and our abilities in this country. Are you sure that what we have at present in terms of the National Qualifications Framework, that is still something that is appropriate? And the reason why I'm asking this, sir, is we have experienced in the last number of years that the South African training system and the skills development system has not been able to cope with the demands of the country. And we must be looking for the reasons for that wide and far. And I was just wondering whether the qualifications framework may have contributed to the skills shortage that we currently have, and the fact that the numbers of those that qualify with the necessary skills have dropped sharply. That's my first question. The second one is, what are the possibilities of us making use more of international qualifications and also funding training in international qualifications? And the reason why I'm asking that is I was recently in discussion with a person from the Murray and Roberts Construction Group, which said that we needed a number, and you were talking of hundreds of people, in the construction of the new Kusile Eskom plant. And certain skills were needed in this country, and SAQA could not supply them with a relevant qualification for the skills used by those people. The closest one to those people that are all working with steel was that of carpentry. And the international qualification was not available. And in the end, those learners did the work, and they got the training, but they had to go away without any South African or actually any qualification. So we've got these problems, and I was just asking, what are you doing from SAQA's side to address the gap where we don't have appropriate South African qualifications, and we need them at short notice? Thank you.
Just as a matter of interest, is there, on a question on the National Learners Records Database, is there any kind of collaboration between SAQA and the Human Resource Council? Is there some kind of a partnership, or is there a duplication of the work done by them and by SAQA?
I'm not interested in how SAQA itself interacted with that process, and how does it happen that we end up in such a situation for a very long time. know there are professional bodies to which these individuals as well should belong to, and they should be either standing from that level, but there should be some interaction or some alignment of the program, so that no body just gets enough other bodies without them taking responsibility. All of us are looking for it to do so. And here's the other issue is, in the absence at that point of PCGO, what was happening? Though we have been in these meetings condemning some institutions that have got programs or modules which are not accessible, and there was no real action against that. Not that as close entities were flying by night, some of them registered and so on, but within them, they were also running programs that were without accreditation. And they were taking advantage of some gaps and so on, and were not doing that. Whether on part-time or short-term kind of qualifications and so on, but there was a gap around which people took advantage of that and just profited. But for now, I think all I'm interested in is with this registration qualification, the kind of criteria and what is that is being established. How long will it take for the case that gets actually closed sick? We were able to see our people having a real qualification cannot be taken advantage of that situation. The other goes to the articulation. One of the important of this is to deal with this position qualification. Are we able to put or push later on that so that it does not just happen at their own education and things without us knowing how long should that be? The last one, sir. PCGO is supposed to be up and running on its own, so that it's not just dependent on SAFA, whereas the appreciation they should be given that SAFA is in the method to see them fully functional or fully fledged as an entity. But can we be assured of how long will that process proceed and running on their own? They can't remain a baby of SAFA forever. So I think somewhat there should be an understanding of what they should be able to deal with that. The employment equity kind of it's like they are not resistant to what was happening in Manchester. What's your take on this? When can you be able to comply with the expectations by the government? I think we have to do a good job in this particular way.
Just one question. One of the things that you do to provide service for the verification of the achievement of qualification in South African institutions, I think it was last year or another year where the committee raised an issue with the University of Zululand. I don't know whether it was with yourself or other qualification or the CHE, where it transpired that there were degrees that were offered at that institution. On to find, after finishing those degrees, that those qualifications were non-existent. The students, there was a strike over such issue. I don't know how far you went into that matter or whatever.
I think in that connection, Honorable Mbwanjani, I think SAQWA must give us a list of unaccredited sure that the rest of Limpopo, there are programs that are unaccredited, and we heard that from students, not from the professorate. And when I asked, they acknowledged that we think we need that because we don't think we should allow our students to study for programs under the impression that those programs are in fact accredited only to learn when they would like to join the labor market, that in fact to some extent their qualifications are worthless. And again, professional bodies, we know that these must be autonomous structures and so on in relation to their area of operation. But it would seem that these professional bodies are gradually usurping the powers that we thought should lie inside governance. Now, these bodies apparently are the final arbiter about the relevance and acceptance of qualification. If you could just shed light around that issue, because we really are interested to know that, because it's our area as legislators, to see how that we venture to ensure that this area is properly regulated. Basically, those are the things. Just as a comment, as a committee, we are very, very concerned on the question of articulation. It would seem that institutions do not want to articulate between and amongst themselves. It would seem that universities do not want to do anything with further education and training institutions, and probably even the FETs among themselves. So this, question of seamless, career development by students is really, really stagnated, and I think we need to really have a way in which we break this mud. The second question is the very question that Makuben has raised, the issue of RPL. I think we need to move with speed on that one and see to what extent we make an impact in terms of beginning to recognize this knowledge acquired by our people through participation in the economy. We know the historical inequities that has caused the situation, so we need to really address that as very, very urgently. That was just a comment. Can you just get to the answers?
Thank you very much, Chair. What we didn't do in the presentation is in detail outline what are the measurables. In fact, when we have submitted our full strategic plan to Parliament, and in the strategic plan there are clear measurable effects in terms of that. So if there are particular areas that members are concerned about, we're very happy to take it up. But from our perspective, in fact, we draw up the strategic plan in such a way that we do have measurable results, because there's also audits. In fact, the audit is starting the 11th of April. As part of the audit, we need to put together performance information, program performance information, that the auditor general then check, whether we meet those ones. So I'm not too sure, maybe what we must do the next time, Chair, is when we do the presentation, that we also put that in. Then, in fact, the point is that, it becomes too detailed and we will be, speaking about the whole plan. But, we can certainly do that if that's what the committee needs and wants us to do, Chair. So that's the issue about the targets and the goals and measures both then. Chair, the second question is with regard to whether we have contributed to the skill shortages. Now, Chair, the thing is that one needs to understand that what SACWA does in terms of the NCF is that we put together a broad framework within which the education and training system function. Now, I don't think that we can be blamed if at the end of delivery, where people are not doing, you know, doing that. Because, I mean, you know, we can't go to providers and say, you shall do the following. So what I'm saying is that, you know, we set up the system. If one makes an analysis of where the skill shortages are, then in actual fact there are qualifications and stuff that's available in terms of that. So one needs to look at the delivery system rather than to look at the kind of regulated framework responsible for that. So, I mean, we can't take any responsibility or blame for that, Chair. The issue is about international qualification. Now, you know, let me explain, you know, how these things work. If, for example, there's a need for qualification, you know, wherever that might be, what happens in fact is that a particular need can be identified by people that said, we need this particular thing, and then there's a process where one develops the qualifications and pass qualifications, and then, you know, that gets registered on, you know, onto the NQF. In terms of the new NQF Act, if there's a qualification needed in the area of trade and occupation, people would go to the QCO and say, this is what we need, and so on. But also, on the other hand, that those, you know, that the QCO or the other quality councils can also say, when they make an analysis, they can say, this is the area of particular need, and then they can take the initiative. So it happens in both, you know, kind of both ways. And it was, so there shouldn't be a situation that develops where there's a kind of qualification vacuum, you know, in the way that you have described and so on. Now, we've also had situations where international bodies, what they do, they collaborate with local bodies and so on. And then, you know, those qualifications are registered. There are examples where there are international qualifications registered on the NQF, you know, that people do in partnership. So I'm saying that the system exists, you know, for what you described, you know, that shouldn't happen anymore. The fourth question deals with, is there collaboration between the HSRC and the NRC, and isn't there duplication? Now, Chair, I am unaware that there's anybody in the country that has got, you know, the information that is, you know, housed and kept by the NRC. In actual fact, the HSRC, when they do research, in fact, they would come to us and they would say, can you give us the information that you've got, depending on the kind of study and analysis that they do. So there's collaboration between us. And there isn't, as far as I know, any duplication, you know, of the kind of database and so on. The way that it is structured, we must get information in terms of the higher education sector from the Council on Higher Education, and will give the information to us. When it comes to trade and occupation, the information must come from the QCO. At the moment, because the QCO is an establishment, it comes from the system. And in terms of the general and further education system, that information comes to us from the community. We then pull all that information together, you know, on the NRC. So, you know, so as far as I know and understand, there isn't, you know, duplication in terms of what it is that we are looking for. The question about fraudulent certificates. Now, Chair, let me make this point. There are two kinds of issues that we are faced with here. The one issue is that we have what one would call fraudulent or illegal providers. Now, the illegal providers, it is actually an easy thing to deal with because they are not registered to offer qualifications. They are not accredited and so on. And so one can deal with it And in fact, the lease has been going, I mean, I've been sitting on a committee that has been coordinated by the Department of Education, where the police are part of it, where the NTA is part, where the DGI is part of it, and so on, so that one can deal with, you know, the commercial stuff and so on. So all of those bodies are part of a committee, and they clarify the policy and implement it. Agencies go in and they close them down and so forth. So there's not a problem in terms of that. The problem that we are faced with is what I would call illegal practices, where you have legal providers that is involved with illegal practices. I think one of the members raised the issue about the University of Zululand. In fact, this afternoon on the television, we will appear on the television this afternoon dealing with the University of Venda, or, you know, where students, where there's been three qualifications that this legitimate institution is running and is saying to students that these qualifications are registered and they're accredited and they're lying to the public. So, I mean, we have checked, you know, this is gone, we will say that it's often, it is not registered and it is not accredited. So the problem, I mean, the main problem that we have, as far as I can see, is with those institutions, both in the public sector as well as in the private sector. Now, the next question that the, you know, that committee can ask, I mean, so what are you doing about it? I mean, again, I mean, what we do is, we, you know, we record the accreditation, we put together the framework and so on. But it's the different agency that must deal with that. And as I said, we are part of, you know, of an agency that goes in and they deal with people and so on. You know, the Council on Education, you know, deals with those institutions at the higher education level. Umalusi deals with it in terms of further education and so on. So I'm saying that, you know, that is, you know, what the policy council are meant to do. Then what makes this even more complicated in a way is when it comes to schools, that is the responsibility of the Department of Basic Education. As it were. So in other words, I mean, if one then looks at the system as a whole, it is those bodies that you know, that need to deal with it. But as I said, you know, what we have been able to do is to bring all the stakeholders together in one committee to clarify things and so on, and then to get, you know, people to act on it. Okay. The issue about the doctors. Now, the status that SAQA got at the moment in terms of the Interest Act is, we are a body that is able to evaluate a qualification, a foreign qualification, and can say, this is how it fits into the South African context. But it is the professional council who has got the responsibility of, ensuring that people do have a license to practice. So therefore, that is the stuff that they need to police in terms of their own act. So, you know, so I think it's quite an important thing to understand the difference what we do and what, you know, what the professional bodies do. So from that perspective, the issue about the doctors is clearly something that falls within our professional council, you know, in their domain. If there are fraudulent engineers, then it is the responsibility of the engineering council, you know, to deal with that in terms of license to practice. Chairperson, the question about, I've spoken about this issue of, you know, what I would call, you know, illegal practices. I'm going to come back to the issue of articulation because I think it's quite an important point that you have raised. The key issue about getting the QC up and running, Chairperson, we can do and we can support as far as we can. At the moment, the QCO needs to put in place a number of structures in terms of the PNSA. And they are housed within the Department of Higher Education and Training. I think it's probably appropriate that you need to ask this question to the QCO in terms of time frame and so on. I mean, we can't answer the question. You know, we assist in terms of providing staff, in terms of providing advice, and so on and so forth. You know, we spend an inordinate amount of time. You know, Amit, myself, and Mark, you know, the CEOs sitting on the board, you know, giving our advice. The CHE Sakwa and we need to make available a whole range of different things. So, but that question is unfortunately the question. We would like it to happen by yesterday. the issue, I mean, I've dealt with the issue of the verification, you know, in terms of the certificates and so on. Now, and I think I've dealt with the question about the professional bodies. Chair, the issue of RPL, I think, you know, you have raised that, and we have given you given a report, and we are saying we're hoping that this will be taken to the next level in terms of, you know, the ministerial tasking and so on. We are preparing the motivation. We'll go there, and we hope, in fact, that, you know, that this process will drive us forward. The issue about the permit equity target, Chair, what we do when we put together our strategic plan, there is a plan that we put together in terms of the employment equity. There are clear targets that we have outlined in that, you know, in terms of that, with time frames and so on. So I'm not sure what else we need to do other than that is there, in our detailed plan. And we're really working towards all of it. For example, one of the issues is that we have not been meeting the disability target. I mean, you know, we at the moment at 3%, and we should be at 4%. And, you know, we have made it clear, you know, to all our staff at City, I mean, and to our managers, this is what we must be. And, you know, there's a constant effort, in fact, you know, to try to be there. The issue about articulation. The minister, when he welcomed the new Sakwa board, was saying clearly one of the areas that we need to focus on is the area of the articulation between colleges and universities. It is a task that he said, this is something that we would like you to work on as a matter of urgency. We have put this, issue certainly on the agenda of our CEO committee and the NPF forum, and we need to talk through what are the kinds of things that one can do in terms of that. At the same time, Chair, Amit, you know, may want to focus and talk a little bit more about that. On the one hand, you know, the universities do have the right to decide on their own admission criteria and so on. But also when we were doing strategic planning on Saturday, there was a clear issue, a number of issues that people have identified that we actually need to take forward. And for example, if one looks at the National Certificate Vocational, the National Certificate Vocational allows people that is in colleges to go to universities, a university of technology, if they meet certain criteria in terms of, you know, what makes them eligible to get into, into university. So part of what we are wanting to do and the research that we are setting up is to look at precisely how this works and where the problem is, and whether there are additional things that have been placed on, you know, learners and so on. But I mean, as I said, you know, that is something that we're beginning to look at. But at a broader level, one of the things that we have accepted to do is to put in place this program of work where the first step in a way is to say, what is the occupational qualification framework looks like? And so we are hoping, in fact, that through the processes that we've decided on jointly, that by by July this year, that we would at least have put in place the occupational qualification framework and the general further and training qualification framework. That is promulgated already, the HCS is promulgated already. And then, I mean, there's also a review that is happening, within the HCS. Ahmed will speak about that in detail, I'm sure. But, you know, so that we can, when we have those things in place, we can then begin to talk more carefully about articulation across the software. It is not an easy subject to change, but, you know, but we are aware of that, and, you know, we are applying our minds, you know, in a system. Thank you, Chair.
Yes, I think at this stage I must thank you for your presentation. It has been very expansive. We are hoping that you would strive to achieve what you have said to ourselves so that we can improve the education terrain. You know, as we were speaking, some ideas were just floating in my mind about how we could complement the funding formula for universities in the future, you know. And because they have got varying admission criteria, maybe, a more accessible university must get more money, you know, must look at the kind of profile of an institution, articulation, where this articulation is equity, then more money, you know. We're thinking, you know, when we're sitting here around such issues, so that the transformational response of an institution should then edit credits towards a funding formula. Those who think about funding formulas must already think around such ways. Just on a lighter note, let me say thank you. We are going to break for about 10 minutes, after which then we'll proceed with the second presentation. Thank you very much. From the Council on High Education. Thank you.
Thank you. Sure, let me begin with three introductory comments. The first is to note an apology from the Chair of Council, Professor Mangani, who, because of the short notice, was unable to take his turn. Secondly, Chair, I want to put the presentation. It provides you a broad overview. And I'm also conscious of the fact that some of the issues that are being raised in the presentation, in a sense, I raised last year when I came and presented the annual report, in large part because I was presenting an annual report with which I had nothing to do. So I was also trying to look forward with some of the challenges. So there may be some overlap between the issues, at least in the way that I've covered. I've largely focused in the presentation on the work that we are planning to do, and I will highlight some of the work that we've done in the past year. And the third sort of contextual thing, as we said in the introduction to the strategic plan, is the plan has to be located in the fact that in the last 2 years or so, the CAC has gone through a process of relative instability, in the sense that the previous CEO there was for a short period of time, subsequent to the resignation of the CEO, for a period there was no CEO in place. And there was an interim CEO until I took post in May. So we've used this period post-May to both relook at the organizational structure, the functions of the work of the organization in the context of the new mandate as a quality council. So I just wanted to put that as a context in terms of how to locate this. In addressing the issues, I'm largely going to focus on what are the four mandate areas or functions of the CAG. The first which is to advise the Minister of Higher Education and Training on any aspect of higher education, either at the request of the Minister or at the initiative of the CHE. In this sense, the CHE is different from the other quality councils, partly because of the history when it was formed. This particular mandate was given to it. Secondly, and the core mandate of the CHE, which is the quality assurance mandate, in which we accredit programs of higher education institutions. Some of the issues that have come up earlier around the Limpopo agenda and so forth, maybe we can pick up on that. The issue of auditing higher education institutions, and thirdly, promoting quality assurance. This was the initial core mandate of the CHE, and on which the CHE has executive responsibility. In a sense, the minister doesn't directly have any role to play in that. Thirdly, what is one, the new mandate that has been added as a result of the CHE, as a result of the changes to the National Qualifications Framework Act, and the CHE is now Quality Council, and the additional functions, which, as Joe pointed out earlier, which relate both to the sub-framework, the Higher Education Qualifications Framework, which was previously the responsibility of SACWA, standard-setting mandate, as well as the national data database issues that were raised earlier. And finally, which is linked to the advice function of the CHE, is the CHE is meant to sort of monitor trends in higher education, publish information, and so forth, report on the state of higher education. So I'm going to focus, at least use advice and monitoring as one function, and then look at the quality assurance issues. In terms of monitoring and evaluation, the first point I want to make, and the point that I raised last year, is that in the recent past, this has been the weakest part of the CHE's work. In the initial inception of the CHE, there was a lot of policy and monitoring work done, partly linked at the time to the sort of fairly vigorous policy debates in higher education. Subsequently, as it started implementing the quality assurance function, which started in 2004-05, the monitoring and evaluation function sort of didn't die a natural death, but was downplayed. And for a long time, there was no formal directive focusing on that. A directive was established in 2008, but very small, very weak, without the appropriate capacity. So it's an area that we are now beginning to, as we say in the strategic plan, is an area that needs to be strengthened. We need to build capacity in taking this forward. In terms of advice, since 2008, there has been very little advice that has been provided, either because there has been no request from the minister, and also because some of the work of the CHE, as I said, has been affected by its capacity. In part, the lack of a request from the minister has also got to do with the fact that the new administration is finding its own new policy framework and so forth. We have, however, recently, in fact in the last 2 weeks, received a request from the Minister for advice on three aspects. One is the effect of whether a community service scheme should be established for graduates, similar to the scheme that's currently in place for Funza Lushaka, where the state provides bursaries and as part of the bursary requirement, students have to work for a period of time as teachers. And so the question the minister is asking is, can this be expanded to other aspects? Secondly, the establishment of a central education system. As you know, or as you would have seen in the media both this year and last year, there's been an enormous push at institutions at the beginning of the year for access once the matric results come out. At the moment, institutions have different processes. Some institutions have fairly strict programs where prior to, by October, November, they've already made their decisions and provided provisional places. In other cases, as you saw at UJ, they accept late applications, so have those large queues of students outside. In many other institutions, particularly in rural areas, they have walk-in registrations, which means the institutions can't plan what the student intake is going to be. There was a number of years ago in the late 90s not late 90s, I think it was in 2002, when the then Department of Education commissioned a study on the establishment of a central education service. The advantages of such a service would be that students apply to one point. They don't. It's also less costly because you don't have to pay an admissions application fee to every institution you're applying for. And the process is well established in many countries and works fairly well. At the time, there was quite a lot of resistance from higher education institutions who saw it as an infringement of institutional autonomy. In my view, quite wrongly. I've been subject to such a process in the past in the United Kingdom in the 1970s, and institutions make their own decisions. All this is done is it administers a service to which students apply, and institution decides whether it wants to offer a place or not based on its particular admissions requirements. So because of the resistance at the time, and because there was a change in administration from, I'm forgetting, in 2000, from whenever Minister Atmal was there, Minister Pandor came in, so the thing was put on the back burner. It's something that was in the white paper of 1997, so it's not a new proposal. So the minister is asking us to revisit and advise on whether the previous investigation and the proposals that were put forward, what our view on that is. So in a sense, not doing new work because the work has already been done, it may be updating. As you know, there is a service in KwaZulu-Natal where the KZN institutions have an education service, which has had mixed success, partly because the institutions themselves, their commitment to the service is mixed. They don't use it fully. And the third area that the minister has asked for advice is on what is the CAT's views on how teaching and learning, particularly improving throughput and success rates, can be improved in higher education. And in this case, I linked it in the presentation to, we had raised this last year, there had been a previous discussion with the minister about doing a review of the undergraduate degree structure, and with the current three-year undergraduate degree, that's not a professional qualification, is appropriate given the context of the transition from school to university. So those are three areas in which the minister has requested advice and which we will be working on. Our council, the council had its first meeting. It's not a new council, but a large number of new members have been appointed. It had its first meeting on Thursday. It's on the agenda and we will be taking it forward over the next few months. More generally, in terms of monitoring what we're looking at currently, is in our view, the CAT should be, in general, providing analysis, if you want, indicators of the performance of higher education linked to national policy goals and objectives. So there's a whole set of policy goals and objectives which were outlined in the National Plan for Higher Education, from access to equity and staffing, a whole range of things. And in our view, this should be the bread and butter of the CAT. It should be, because it gets, as Joe had mentioned, the repository of higher education data. It should be using the data and doing data analysis, putting out publications on what the latest trends and access are, what some of the issues may be, and so forth. So it's a project we want to take forward as part of building the capacity of the monitoring and evaluation function of the CAT. We are also in the process, you know, as you know, we in the last 5 years have undertaken institutional audits. The audit cycle, the first cycle of audits is coming to an end this year. The two remaining institutions that are being audited, that's the Mangosuthu University of Technology and the Walter Sisulu University of Technology. We have, in the meantime, in the last year, commissioned work from the audit reports on looking what are the audits telling us about teaching and learning, about research, and about community engagement in higher education institutions. So once these two audits are completed, we will find that the data from those will be integrated, and we will be releasing, hopefully, towards the latter half of the year, these sort of research studies on what the audits indicate in terms of those three broad areas. As I indicated, Chair, at the start, our big problem is our capacity currently. We should be doing a lot more work in terms of monitoring, in terms of, as I said, both the policy goals and objectives. The Chair raised earlier the issue of funding. not the specific issue that you raised, but we have a funding formula that's 4 or 5 years, that was introduced about 5 years ago. In a sense, if the CAC was doing its monitoring work, it should have been monitoring the impact of that formula as it was being implemented. And we've done none of this. So we need to rethink our role, particularly to build our capacity. And not necessarily all of it has to be in-house capacity, but also to work with other institutions in order to be able to do so. The areas in this, I think I did raise last year, that both subject to resources, and I will come back to resources and capacity, but it's not only dependent on capacity because it's work that we can commission out. The areas we are looking at, which is a big issue in terms of the minister's new thinking about post-school education, which came up earlier, what is the interface between further education and higher education? How better can you structure it, particularly between further education colleges and the universities of technology? Because there should be greater synergy, if you want, in terms of the kind of programs that they offer. Second area is around the changing nature of the academic profession. You know, there's a big issue about whether we're training the next generation of academics. But I think it also needs to be looked more carefully in the context of how the academic profession itself is changing. It's not what it used to be anywhere else. In all parts of the world, it's changing. In the past, there was 10-year of appointment, which you had lifetime appointments and so forth. That's no longer the case. People get appointed on contract. So there are a whole set of issues about the academic profession that we don't fully understand, which may impact on why people may not be going into the academic profession. The third area we want to look at is issues around student governance, and particularly the more recent decision by some institutions to preclude student political organizations from participating in the SRC elections, ostensibly on the grounds that it creates conflict in the institution. But it has broader imperative. I suspect that it's constitutionally a problem. You know, you can't stop people at the right of freedom of association. But there are other issues relating to SRCs, particularly in the context of the institutions, if you want multi-campus institutions. So if you take Walter Sisulu, it's got 3 campuses. But in Umtata itself, it's got 2 campuses, not very far from each other, but both campuses have SRCs. And the tension between the 2 SRCs and what is the central SRC. So I think there are issues about SRCs that we need to, this is not for advice, but to flag what the issues may be and what institutions could possibly consider in terms of addressing, rethinking how SRCs can be structured. And then final area, which we are talking to Umar Lucy about and to Gisa, the Higher Education South Africa about, is doing some studies looking at the results, the national senior certificate results, and comparing them with the benchmark tests that HESA has introduced and which is being done at a number of our institutions in order to, not for access purposes, but as a diagnostic tool, but to see what that is saying. And there's mixed, anecdotally there's mixed information. Some institutions say there's really no relationship between the benchmark test and what the senior certificate results say, but certainly suggesting that the senior certificate is more reliable for them than the benchmark test. Others would say that's not the case, but nobody really knows. So we thought, because this is really an Umar Lucy function, the senior certificate, that it may be useful to collaborate with them to develop a research project of looking at that. In the past year here, we've produced 2 publications. One is which is linked to what was the National Review of Teacher Education. As you know, 3 or 4 years ago, all the B.Ed and M.Ed programs were reviewed. In some cases, some programs were closed down, some programs were given conditional accreditation and so forth. And as a result of that, there was a study done, what's come out of that process, which was published in the course of last year. We also brought out a publication, the South African Student Engagement Project, which is done in collaboration with the University of the Free State, which looks at what do students actually do, how much time they spend in lectures, how much time do they spend on social activities, what do lecturers do in the classroom, and so forth. Again, it's quite a useful contribution. It's part of a broader international study done in many other countries. South Africa has started doing it for the last 2 years. And it's quite a useful indicator in looking at what happens to teaching and learning, how much time is spent on tasks, and so forth. and that was published, and it's a project that continues at the moment. And some of these publications, we have a whole range of publications that we can make available to the committee on request. If I can then move on to the qualifications framework, as I indicated last year, and as Joe mentioned earlier, at the moment the only QC that has a gazetted framework is the CHE. The Higher Education and Qualifications Framework was gazetted in 2008. However, it's become clear in more recent times that there may be problems and gaps with the framework, particularly in the context of differentiation, because the framework, in a sense, was pushing all institutions, the DOTs and the universities, into the same direction, and was not providing clearly differentiated qualifications that would be specific to the universities of technology. So, for instance, previously the UOTs offered, for instance, an MTech, Masters of Technology. That's been taken out of the HEQF, and it provides for a master's qualification, but not for a master's of technology. So there are issues from a differentiated point of view. There are also issues about whether in certain professional qualifications, particularly in the health sciences, where for the auxiliary health sciences, things like radiology and so forth, where it's been argued that there's a greater need for a two-year diploma than the three-year diploma that's currently provided for is not appropriate. And then a whole set of other issues that people have raised. So we did ask for submissions from the higher education institutions and various stakeholders. We are currently processing the submissions that we have received. We will be having a process of consultation on the outcomes of the submissions with the sector going forward between now and May, and we intend to make recommendations to the minister around mid-year about what possible amendments need to be made to the HEQA in order to address the current gaps. It's a new area of work. The second new area is standard setting, which really refers to what are the minimum standards when you're doing, if you're doing a BSc, what are the minimum standards that the qualification should have? And those are minimum standards that should cut across institutions. We're not talking about the curriculum per se, the content of the curriculum, but what are the minimum standards that you would expect a Bachelor of Science or a Bachelor of Arts graduate to come out with at different levels, what would be a master's standard, a PhD standard, and so forth. This is a new function. We have just recently established from January of this year, a directorate, which we are in the process of making the appointments, and we will be releasing for consultation with the higher education sector a framework for how this process, which we envisage will take 3 or 4 years to complete, will take place. I should just also mention in relation to qualification framework that we do have links, particularly in the SADC region, we've been working with Rwanda, the Botswana, where we signed memoranda of understanding in order to assist in where they're setting up similar sorts of qualification frameworks and so forth. The second area in quality assurance is program accreditation. Specifically, one is really the bread and butter. It largely focuses on, I think, the issue that was raised earlier, there are a set of historical programs in higher education that were deemed accredited at the time that the CHE was established. All new programs that institutions offer have to come to the CHE, both public and private. The majority of the programs that come to us currently come from the private providers. We are being inundated, if you want. We had anticipated in our previous strategic plan that we would get 100 programs per year that we would need to accredit. In the last year, we had 400 programs, which has meant the workload has increased. We're having to extend the work of the number of people we employ. And as you would appreciate, a lot of this is compliance with a set of criteria. It's in a sense a paper assessment of whether institutions are meeting the criteria that are required. I'll come back to how we did the teacher education thing, because that may address some of the more qualitative issues that we need to look at. We also this year having to start aligning the programs that institutions have with the higher education qualification framework. because institutions had developed their programs prior to when the framework was presented by the minister in 2008. There are some 20, we estimate that there are 20,000 programs in public higher education institutions, on the books of public higher education institutions. Many of them may be redundant, they may not actually be offering them, but they're there formally on the books. So it's quite mind-boggling. We're not quite sure how we're going to manage this process. We think about 60 to 70% of the programs would largely be, would fit in with the HEQS because they meet the broad requirements. So those should be relatively easy to manage, but all of those are going to have to be submitted to the HEQC, and we are going to have to assess them. So if there are programs that are, as part of this process, that have not been properly accredited in the past, we should be hopefully able to weed those out. We estimate about 20 or 30% of the programs would require some curriculum change because they don't meet the current requirements of the HEQS in terms of credit levels, how the program has been structured, the credits that are provided, and so forth. And then we think about 5% of programs are probably outdated and would fall away. But at this stage, we had engagements. We ran a workshop with higher education institutions in January. We've agreed on an implementation framework with them and how we're going to unfold this over the next 3 years. So it's a fairly major undertaking to clean up, if you want, in line. And the HEQS may well change, which may create further complications. So it's almost impossible task to do without knowing exactly what the new changes may be. But we think we can manage for most of the programs. And then finally, as part of this HEQS process, we are looking at self-accreditation. The institutions that have the systems in place and the procedures in place could introduce programs without formally coming each time to the HEQC, and whether HEQC refuses every 4 or 5 years to make sure that those programs meet the requisite criteria, which will also take some pressure off the current work that we do. Thirdly, this is a new area of work. It was there before national reviews, which relates, as we say in the slide, to the reaccreditation of programs. It has a very high impact because it's looking at the quality of the programs, but by looking at the programs that each institution offers, and it's done via a peer review process. So we send in a team of a panel of peers who visit every institution. For we've done it for the MBA and for teacher education. And look carefully, so it's not a paper exercise. They go in and do a careful study of the programs. As you know, the MBA thing, which was done 6 or 7 years ago, created a major, at the time, outcry, because a number of MBA programs, both in the private and public institutions, were deaccredited. And in some cases, programs were given conditional accreditation and they had to meet certain criteria. A similar thing happened with the teacher education programs. Although no programs were deaccredited, a whole range of conditions were set in institutions have had over the last few years to show how they were meeting those. So if you want, from a quality of the issues we were discussing earlier, about it's very difficult, unless you do an exercise of that sort, to look at what the quality of the program is, because they often meet the paper requirements, the paper criteria. It's only when you go and assess what is happening in practice of the institution. But as you can imagine, this is a very highly intensive process, and one can manage maybe one or two a year, not more than this. This function the CAC has done stopped in 2008, largely because of resource constraints, both in terms of personnel, but also financial resources. We've decided to re-establish the director by redirecting funds from another director, which I will come to, because we think this has high impact. It makes a real change in quality in a way that the other exercises don't. So we have advertised the post. We've just shortlisted in the process of doing interviews over the next few weeks. So we should have this director up and running in the course of this year. The two areas we've identified, one is social work, which was something that had been previously, the groundwork had been done. The second is law. As you know, there was a study that was commissioned by the Deans of Law in LLB Curriculum Review, which ended last year, which we released the findings but not the report, because quite frankly, in my view, the report was of poor quality because of the methodology used. This is the survey methodology, talking to people in the legal profession, institutions. They didn't really go in depth into understanding what the problems were. But it's quite clear that legal qualifications offered in different institutions have very different ways in which they're structured, both in terms of the modules, the amount of time that students spend in different modules and so forth for the same kinds of courses. So we think a national review on law courses would be an appropriate thing to do. First, the third area is quality promotion and capacity development. I'm not going to spend a lot of time, because we work with institutions to build capacity. We had a dedicated director for this, which we've shifted the resources to national reviews because we feel that the quality system in general has matured within institutions. That having a dedicated directorate is difficult to find the appropriate people who can do the work, and it's better to have a focus and to bring peer teams together to work with institutions if and when necessary. So what we've done is we think national reviews is more important, so we've in a sense shifted the resources away from this to national reviews. Third, finally, institutional audits. As you know, as I've indicated, we're coming through the first cycle. The two audits that remain. I will talk separately about the audit of UKAZ because we were asked to focus on that specifically. For the second cycle, we have recently released, and we will be quite happy at some point to present to the committee what our thinking on the second cycle is. As we say, the first cycle looked at policies and procedures for quality assurance. The second cycle is going to focus more narrowly on teaching and learning, what happens in the classroom. What are the issues that impact on teaching and learning, and therefore on teaching success rates and so forth. We've released, as I said, a framework for consultation with the higher education sector. The closing date is, I think, the end of this week, and we will revise that framework based on those before finalizing it. But it's something that the committee may be interested in considering. Chair, we'll come back to the UKZS, and I just want to finish the overall presentation. We have a whole range of organizational challenges. When I first started, I had identified problems in HR, particularly in the fact that the policies were in many cases outdated. We did not have staff development policy in place, or if there was a policy in place, it was not being implemented. We were not budgeting for things like staff development and so forth. So we appointed an HR manager last year, and we, in the process, we should by mid-year this year have new policies and processes in place which would address what were some of the more fundamental HR challenges that we faced. Secondly, we have also identified, we appointed a new set of internal auditors this year, and the brief we gave them was to say, sort of, do a fairly comprehensive audit of all our processes and so forth, because we're not sure that what we have in place and the previous audit reports have identified some of the challenges and problems we face. And true to form, the auditors have uncovered no fraudulent activities and so forth, but again, problems with the policies and processes in place, but they're not always properly implemented and so forth. So we've just recently, that the results of the audit will be presented to the council this week, and we're putting in place the steps between now and the middle of this year in order to address the particular gaps and problems that the internal audit has identified. In terms of budget, our budget for the coming financial year is 40 million. The state grant is 36 million. We were cut our budget. The state grant was cut by 10%. We were expecting the equivalent of 39 million rand. And it's been cut 3 million for next year, 4 million for 2012-2013, and by 5 million rand for 2013-2014. The only outside income we have currently is we charge the private providers for the accreditation service that we provide. It's a very minimal charge, so we are currently reviewing because we don't recover our cost for the service that we provide. We charge 2,500 rand per new program that private providers submit. So we are reviewing that and will be incrementally increasing it over the next few years so that we're better able to recover the cost for providing that service. We are not, the budget is tight. I'm not unduly, or I shouldn't say this because we should always ask for more money. Because budgeting processes in the CHE, I think, have been problematic. We're quite friendly. I think budgets have in the past been some stuff about what's nice to have without clear looking at the sort of historical trends of what we spent, etc. So we do need to tighten up our budget processes. So in that sense, it's a good wake-up call. It would have some impact on our ability to do some of the work, some of the kinds of research projects we've identified. I don't think it's going to affect our core work. The core work that we do is not likely to be affected. We have had, because we've had in the last 18 months a large number of vacancies, so we're hoping that we will get some rollover funds that the department would support that will see us through the transition. So we are concerned, but at this stage not unduly. Some of the other quality councils, I think, have a much bigger problem as far as budgets go, particularly UMRUC. I have less sympathy for SACWA because the budget hasn't been cut all that much. In terms of vacancies, we currently have 10 vacancies. We have a staff complement of 55. We, as I said, some of our new directors, which we established towards the end of last year, we're in the process of doing interviews. 6 of the posts were advertised, 2 have been filled. We're doing interviews for 4 of the posts between now and April. So all things being equal, we should have filled those posts. The remaining 6 posts we had not advertised because it was dependent on who we appointed, because they post below those directors and managers. So we will advertise one of those people on the test. Okay, finally, if I can turn. So we do have a whole range of organizational challenges which we need to address. I think we've had, for the last 11 years, the CHE has unqualified mandates, which is positive. But I think it may also have resulted, therefore, in a bit of unqualified orders. So you think everything's okay, but there's looseness in policies and processes, but nobody looks at it. And I think some of the audit companies, quite frankly, including the auditors that the AG appoints, don't always do as comprehensive as they charge us a lot of money for it. We pay R500,000 or so annually. I'm not sure that always we get our money's worth. We're fairly happy with the new internal auditors, and this year the AG's office will be auditing the CHC directly. So we hope it will change some of the practices that we have. If I can finally turn to the UKZN issue. And I wanted to leave it to the end because obviously it's a contentious issue. As you know, there was an audit done. Unfortunately, all of this again predates me, so I'm always trying to clean up for things that happened prior to my arrival. There was an audit of UKZN as part of the institutional audit process done in 2008. As part of the normal process of an audit, at the end of the audit is a peer process. So there's a panel of peers that are appointed, which are discussed with, and the institution has the right to indicate whether it has any objections to the panel and so forth. At the end of the audit, the panel presents an oral report to the institution. The institution at that stage does not have the right to ask any questions because it's a provisional finding, to give a quick rough and dirty of what they found. The panel report is then written, which is finalized by the panel, which then goes to the ATQC, which ensures which can make further changes if it feels the panel has not been consistent in the findings in relation to other audit reports and so forth. The UKZN audit, as I said. Secondly, the other important point to bear in mind that the audit process is a negotiated process, and it's a process based on trust. At the time that the audits were first mooted in the early 2000s, the agreement institutions were very suspicious of the audits because they saw this as something that Big Brother or Big Sister coming to tell them what to do, that it would be punitive and so forth. So the agreement that was reached at the time is something we may want to revisit for the future in the context of public accountability, is that the audit reports are confidential. So even when audits have not been contentious, the reports are not published. On the CAT website, we put a summary of the report, the main findings, but the detailed report is not public. If anybody wants access to the detailed report, they have to request it from the institution concerned, and it's up to the institution to decide whether it's going to make it available or not. And that's the basis on which this process, so it's based on the notion that whatever information is submitted to the CHE is confidential because institutions prepare self-evaluation reports, they provide all sorts of internal documents and so forth, but even the report itself is not made public. As I said, this may be something, my own view, in future we should look carefully at whether that should continue. Because if the role of audit is public accountability, then the report should be made public. But the current process has been where there has been this notion of confidentiality and an agreement about how the process will be. When an audit report, a draft report is prepared, it's submitted to the institution and the institution is able to respond. There are often factual errors which need to be rectified. If there are issues of interpretation because the panel may not have interpreted institutional information appropriately or correctly or the information. It's similar to an audit process that you go through in the financials. There's a management report or a report given and a management response received. And the report is then redrafted or revised depending on what the issues are and whether it's appropriate to revise the report. In the case of the UK's event audit, prior to a first draft of the report being released or finalized, in January of 2009, the chair of the audit panel, Professor Martin Hall, sent a letter to the CHE, to the Higher Education Quality Committee, to the HEQC, raising a set of concerns about disciplinary procedures that the university had initiated against, I think it was two or three staff members. And in his view, the university's action repudiated the audit process, because the audit process had made findings in general on the climate, the sort of, if you want, industrial relations climate, the climate between management and academic staff and staff in general. There were all sorts of conflicts at UKZN at the time. And he felt that the university's actions were contrary to the spirit of the audit group and in fact impinged on the integrity of the audit. That letter from Martin Hall was leaked, okay, and was left in quite a room of telepapers, as far as I know, at the time. The Vice Chancellor then raised a set of objections, both in relation to the draft report, and suggested that there may be a bias because of the particular role that the chair played and the letter that he wrote, and that secondly, that the letter itself was an interference in institutional processes and impacted on the integrity of the audit. The CHE, as you're aware, from the recent media furore on the matter, appointed a review panel. The review panel did not find anything wrong with the audit process itself, identified a whole range of inaccuracies in the audit report which would have been rectified as part of the normal process. It was unable to determine either whether there was a bias or there wasn't a bias, but it did indicate that the letter and the leak of the letter substantially compromised the audit process. And on that grounds, the CHE made the decision to withdraw the audit report and to look at the new process for auditing the case. So if you want, and as you may, if you essentially it's largely been covered in the Mail and Guardian for a number of weeks, I did do a response which was my own interpretation of what I think had happened. In my view, Martin Hall's letter was inappropriate. The fact that the disciplinary procedure that the institution had initiated had nothing to do with the audit itself. It was not the result of somebody raising issues in the audit panel, and that staff member being disciplined because he or she had given information to the audit panel. That quite clearly would be a problem for the audit process. The conflicts in UKZN predated the audit. There were disciplinary procedures prior to that, and there were disciplinary subsequent to the audit. So the audit, the disciplinary action that the university had nothing to do with the audit process. At any rate, even if the university did, the audit made a finding that the university needed to find other ways of dealing with conflict, other than litigation and disciplinary procedures. But the audit is not in a position to say to instruct an institution what to do. The institution's autonomous. They have a right to decide. The audits are not punitive. They're not binding. The institutions can decide whether it accepts or doesn't accept the findings. But even if it does accept the findings, it doesn't bind in particular staff members' cases, and therefore we shouldn't undertake disciplinary action. And the issue of conflict in institutions between management and staff is not something peculiar to UKZN. It goes across the higher education system. If you look at the report of the Ministerial Committee on Racism and Transformation that came out at the end of, in early 2009, one of the things it comments on that across the board, wherever the committee went, in the majority of the institutions, there was conflict. There were cases, and I know because I was on the secretariat, where people were refusing to speak to the committee unless we switched off. We were taking the proceedings for our own purpose because of the climate supposedly of fear. And I'm not talking about UK for them. So it's a much broader problem in higher education, more generally. But the council, having considered the review panel process and the impact of the letter, withdrew the report. We're not saying that UKZN will not be audited. If you want, the legal equivalent would be where the national public prosecutor doesn't appropriately formulate a charge sheet for the police, I suppose, tamper with evidence, and you have to go back to the drawing board and formulate a new charge sheet. What the council has indicated is that when we go into the next second cycle of the audit, we will do a much broader audit of UKZN than the narrow focus on teaching and learning. So in a sense, we will re-audit the whole of UKZN as part of the second cycle. The audits are a complicated process. We didn't think it appropriate to do it immediately because it involves fairly intensive preparation by the institution. In many cases, a lot of the audit findings, because this happened in 2008, some of, in the sense, the institutions also moved forward. So they would have to redo all of their work in order to submit a new self-evaluation plan and so forth. So I want to emphasize two points because the media, that the council did not, the Vice-Chancellor had the right to raise a set of concerns. The council did not, because the Vice-Chancellor raised concerns, withdraw the report. The council considered the Vice-Chancellor's concerns and then initiated a process of review. And on the basis of that process, came to the conclusion that it would be in the best interest to withdraw the audit report. And secondly, it's not that UKZN will not be audited again. At the end of this year, we would have concluded 21 audits of public higher education, 23 public higher education institutions. The fact that one audit has been withdrawn is a problem. It should have been dealt with appropriately at the time. I think the CAT, quite simply, as I say in the article, should have acted in a more timely fashion and made whatever decisions it wanted to make in 2008-2009. It allowed, for a range of reasons which were internal to the organizational changes in the CAT, it took much longer to address than it should have, which further complicated the process. So, Chair, maybe I should stop there.
Any questions? Proper? I have a warning.
Thank you very much, Mr. Esop, for your comprehensive presentation, especially for dealing so frankly with the last issue. Mr. Esop, I know you've got a council, and the council is probably giving you direction, so I feel a bit on thin ground if I raise a point which I believe might be in need of the attention of the Council on Higher Education. And in a sense, it relates to your last point, and that is the issue of academic leadership and management in South Africa. I'm always concerned or surprised when I see how few academics avail themselves for senior management positions in our academic institutions. I have heard that academics speak of managers because sometimes deans are only appointed for a limited term and then they go back in their positions as academics. That they actually need a period of rehabilitation, the word some institutions use, to get back into your academic field, because you've been out of research, etc., while you're in management. And I see it has not been raised as one of the issues, and may I therefore take the liberty of just raising that. Also linking that to your remark of the relationships and the possible distrust that there may be between academics and the managers of those institutions. It does seem to me to be a challenge in South African tertiary institutions to get people that are prepared in more than one way to take the lead of those. Then, so secondly, and I believe my colleague will be dealing far more extensively with the audit report, I take it that the university has received a draft audit report. And my experience of audit reports is that, by and large, the value that you get from an audit report doesn't lie totally in the report, but your response to that report. The report is, to a large extent, a mirror that's been held up by your peers in which you see yourself, and in which you then get the opportunity to decide whether you're going to apply makeup, take off makeup, you know, where are you going to improve that picture. And may I therefore then ask, to what extent do you believe the Council on Higher Education has, in terms of relationship building with a particular institution, asking to deal with the report as skewed or as imperfect as all reports are, but to take from it, you know, what is necessary for the institution to take it forward. You are talking about the report being slightly outdated, it's dated 2008. On the other hand, it seems to me as if your normal cycle will be very close to 7 years by which you would visit any other institutions again. So I'm not that concerned that 3 years or even 4 years, you know, may have rendered the report and the expenditure of drafting that report therefore to be fruitless. So if you could just respond to, you know, the value and efforts to take whatever is valuable in that report. Because in the end, it's not about the report, it's about the quality of the institution. Thank you.
I'm going to mainly focus on the UKZN report. This letter written by Professor Hall, the confidential letter to the council, he didn't leak the letter. There was a forensic audit, and they could not determine who leaked the letter. Now, I'm surprised by the fact that there's so much focus placed on this letter. The panel consisted of 8 people, and the report was the result of the input of all the panel members. So could you please respond on that specifically? I'm surprised that the letter was actually the main reason why the report was withdrawn. My other question, you said that the appointment of the review panel, there was nothing wrong with the process, if I heard you correctly. But why then was the Vice-Chancellor involved with the appointment of the review panel? They were appointed in consultation with the Vice-Chancellor. So this is not an independent process at all. You've also indicated, I've got a report or article from the Mail and Guardian where you said that nothing like this had happened in the past, and that the audit process made no provision for a resolution such as the one taken on the UKZN. And obviously you have to revise your manual. Have you done so? And what is the outcome then of this revision? Then on the fact that you are going to start with your second cycle as from 2012, will you do the UKZN as soon as possible? Because they are without a report. And you are well aware of the fact that there is a lot of tension between the management of this university, the council, and these disciplinary hearings. And I would like to know what your response is on managerialism at various universities currently in our country. It's absolutely unacceptable. And then also, what was the amount spent on this audit report? Because the taxpayer had to pay for this audit report that was withdrawn. I think you also acknowledge the fact that these reports should be made public, and the public, the taxpayer, is entitled to know what is the content of that report or such a report. Yes, thank you.
Yes, Chair. My first question relates to standardization. I just want to be educated about what separates the standardization that is done by the qualifications authority from the one that is done by the Council for Higher Education. Or let me say, what's the difference? And then my second question relates to, I want to call it the modernization of coursing programs. What happens to those who have qualified, say, 5 years before you modernize? Say, if you downgrade an MBA program to a diploma, what happens to those who qualified maybe 2 or 3 years before you modernize? Then in my other question is, we have merged institutions. When we say the University of Ghana is offering unaccredited courses, what about CHEP and LEDU? Or let me say, we have merged institutions in South Africa. Is there a review? Because some of those measures are not well in as far as we know. Then my last question relates to, okay, let me say, what are the implications of the withdrawn audit report?
Just a few from my side. The last time we were engaged in the ESA, Higher Education South Africa, they suggested, or they were making a proposal as well, that some of the qualifications which currently may be 4 years, some 5 years, 3 year degrees or 4 years, they need to be a 4 year, 5 year degree for qualification. And what informed that was mainly that already they've introduced the vision courses and so on and so on, indirectly. But as students entered, they were first subjected to this year of a bridging course or whatever you call it, and then the actual 3 years. Meaning, even if it's not real curriculum change, but already you're moving towards 4 year degrees, which normally used to be 3 years. Now with this year and there's going to be standard testing and so on and so on, probably moving even towards that direction. I'm saying, how do we interact with the SIO? At what point do they make input to CHP, and how important is that? Can you be able to say something and they go their own way? Is it possible? Or they should adhere to what you say? I know you are a special report, therefore, what you should do, but you should go ahead. But is there any defiance, is there anything that
when they sit on their own, then they have less say, but PhD have not taken our input, and therefore we can go ahead. I think you're getting in the trap of my prisoner for what I'm telling you. Now, your capacity on the neglected area of monitoring and evaluation, now that you want to take up an initial area, I certify that you have the capacity and you'll be able to do it. Or you're still lacking and you feel probably you are not at the point where this monitoring and evaluation could be done. The almost last question here will be the leak of the audit report. Now, that has been, the audit report has been withdrawn. And the rescheduled one will be 21st. And that's what my issue is in terms of whether indeed substantial or significant the leak affected the report, and whether the new report may somewhat differ with the current. Because what if they come the same way, the same outcome as what we, because the effects are the same, almost. Even if it's something here and there, there may be no real difference. But whether if you audit that, you use a credible institution to do the audit, and the results are closer to the truth, or almost the truth, and you restart the process, being sure almost that you'll get the same result, what will be the implication of that if they come out and say, well, you know, I'm saying, even if there was an attitude by the person who did, that attitude may be as a result of the fact, not necessarily that will all happen. Unless it is, yes, but taken into confidence beyond just leaking the information in terms of confidentiality and so on. But I understand that may be wrong, may not be in terms of the thing control. But I'm going beyond that, to say the leak itself may not be compared to the work or effort in terms of audit. And the result that has come out of the census.
Before answers, what I think.
I'm just saying, why the delay? Why 25? Why it can't be done almost immediately? So, well, that can as well be normal auditing in the next term. So, unless it is about financing and so on.
Just to check in terms of the human resource processes, whether you've got all the things I had asked about the presenters and audit committee, risk management strategy, fraud prevention plan, all that, so that we're certain that in fact those instruments are there. So in terms of compliance, we're not really worried. We'll just be working and strengthening them and so on. I think relating to this, I respect the arrangements of keeping the reports private. I would like